org and navigating to the art auction catalog. We ship everywhere.
And remember, supporting WBAI and Pacifica Foundation amplifies the voices of artists like me.
Hi, this is Eric Anderson.
This is Rosie Perez.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is LL Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
We did it before. We'll do it again.
The owners of the Empire State Building where WBAI's transmitter is located have pushed WBAI into a crisis. The crisis is real, and we need your help to turn this crisis around. We need your time, energy, and especially your skills. We need you to volunteer to help build our off-air fundraising campaign. We need grant writers, event planners, social media and computer technology experts, phone banking volunteers, and particularly those experienced with obtaining large donor contributions. Are you an experienced fundraiser? We need you now. Historically, WBAI listeners have shown great heart and courage in the face of political adversity. We must do this again to save our station. Please call 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com and let us know how you could help. Again, please call us at 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com. Together, we will win.
We did it before. We'll do it again.
And the answer is no, they probably can't. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And if you like, oh, nope, I haven't pressed the button. I have to press the silly little button. Okay, starting live video. And, oh, and hopefully on Facebook. We are only on Facebook as long as WBAI's Wi-Fi holds out. If I'm not on Wi-Fi, then I'm on the phone. And this is gigabytes of data. And I don't get gigs of data. But if you go to the Facebook Live page, you will find us there. Or you can go to my page. Hello, Luce. Okay, we've already got 3 viewers. So it's pretty fast. Yes, and Paul is waving at you, and they're putting up little thumbs that scroll across this. You'll see it at home when you go home. At any rate, I think it's time to start the theme music. Don't you all? Let's see. Have they pressed all the buttons? Yes, they have.
Thank you.
and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. I am Jim Freund. With me this morning will be Paul Levinson, a remarkable figure in many ways. Stay tuned.
Happen here. It can't happen here. I'm
yes,
telling you,
here,
my dear,
here,
that it can't happen here. Because I've been checking it out, baby. I checked it out a couple of times. And I'm telling you, it can't happen here. Oh, darling, it's important that you believe me, bop, 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 that it can't happen here. Who could imagine that they would freak out somewhere in Kansas?
Kansas.
Who could imagine that they would freak out in Minnesota?
So I think we can actually voice over this part of It Can't Happen Here from Freak Out by the Mothers of Invention. And, Deb, you're going to love that story. Get tissues handy. And we're also talking to people on Facebook Live, as mentioned earlier. Before we talk with Paul Levinson, announcements. We have announcements. Let's see. The next New York Review of Science Fiction readings will be on, well, the first Tuesday of the month as advertised, and that will be Tuesday, December 5th. And usually, every single year, you know, we bring in our favorite families, just like on broadcast shows. They bring in families. You know, the weatherman brings in the cousins and the sisters and the aunts and everybody. And we do that only, the family that we use every year are Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. But those escapees are in Paris. They are spending a year in Paris. They'll always have Paris. And I am not allowed Paris. Actually, I have a friend named Paris, but that's another story. So we have to, so we're going to have a different kind of an extravaganza. It was originally going to be a musical extravaganza, starting with the wonderful Sarah Pinsker, brilliant writer, at least two-time Nebula nominated, and I think Hugo nominated. And even if she weren't nominated, her stories validate themselves. We've done a couple of them on Lightspeed Magazine, where I work on the podcasts. And the other person of some musical abilities who was going to be with us, hey, Sydney, you ought to be here. I mean, literally, you ought to be on the station. Another story. What was I talking about? Who knows? No, I'm not even on pain. Your mic isn't up. I'm not even talking about painkiller meds this week. You know, it's the pain is still there. The killers are receding, but it's receding, so no killers. But at any rate, it was instead of music, Kat Valenti, Catherine M. Valenti, a writer of genius fantasy, will be presenting a game show. I saw her do it at ReaderCon. It involves her friend Heath. Sarah Pinsker will be one of the contestants, and Kat is going to choose a fourth person. So it's not a reading. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings this coming month won't be any readings. Sorry about that. If you simply want to see great science fiction writers making a room of happy people enervated and have a great deal of fun, be here on Tuesday, December 5th at 7 o'clock. Admission is free. Donations are cajoled. And here is where we are now, which is 388 Atlantic Avenue, ground floor. WBAI is on the third floor, but the Commons Cafe, which seats like 120-something people and has full video capacity, is on the ground floor of this building. And that's where you will be. Right, you will be there, right? Yes, good. And you can meet us all and have a great time. January, we have booked our season. Yow. It's hard to believe, but we have. So January is Brooke Bolander and Sunny Moraine. And February, Gordon Van Gelder, who started the reading series to begin with, has an anthology coming out that he will be touting called Dystopia, which is, I would call simply reality. And, you know, which dystopia are we living in anyway? And Gordon will have several writers to answer that very question. March, April, May. Oh, good God, my phone fell off its stand. Facebook Live just went all the way. Oh, good night, Barbara. Barbara's going to bed now. I'm actually very surprised that Barbara's awake. The little stand you gave me, Barbara, ain't standing. Okay, there we go. It's got a little thing, and Paul is back, and we are still not webcasting. Well, I guess Facebook is the web, but there are other ways to see it, like through a Roku or something like that. So we're still internet casting. But I'll tell you about all those other readings as we close in on them. But right now, I've told you all the way through February. Oh, January will not be the first Tuesday of the month. It will be the second Tuesday, because the first Tuesday of the month is January 2nd. And how many of you are showing up on January 2nd? I didn't think so. So you're still, you know, getting over January 1st. So it's a sleep-in day, and probably sleeping in well past 7 p.m., just collapsing and thinking about how was that Doctor Who special and things like that. So on, and the other, what else? Oh, yes, Victoria will be having its Christmas special, only won't start in the U.S. until February, but some of us are, well, a little ahead of the curve on that. At any rate, that covers us. And if you want to go to the KGB Fantastic Fiction series for this month, you missed it by a few hours. But if you have a TARDIS, you can go back. They'll be putting it up on their website. So Google up KGB Fantastic Fiction and find the website. And Gordon Linsner, who records them, will have handed it over to Matt Kressel, who runs the website and co-hosts the series with Ellen Datlow, who, were you listening last week? And there you go. Okay, I think I have covered announcements for this morning. So now your mic is up, Paul. Okay, do me a favor, tap that mic.
Tap the mic?
Yeah. No.
I'm not that
threatened. Do it again.
Tapping.
Ah, there we go.
Hello.
Yeah, I think some of these mics were reassigned.
All right.
And there's no reason for those on switches to be off, none whatsoever. Do you think, folks, that you're saving electricity by that because of the little green LED light? Do you know how much? Never mind. I have a guest. I won't rant. Hello, Chuck Gannon. So good to see you, or for you to see us.
Hey, Chuck.
Ops Law Signal. Well, let's discuss that privately. At Solstice, Ops lost you, Sydney. That's another story. Okay, so again, for those people who wonder what ghosts I'm talking to, if you have the means of getting onto Facebook, there is a section on Facebook called Facebook Live or just videos. Sometimes they seem to change their interface every week. Or you can go to my personal page, Jim Freund, and you will find us there. Unless you're watching this after the show is over, in which case I will have copied this over to both the WBAI radio web group and to the Hour of the Wolf Facebook group, not web group. I have to remember that. You all have to remember that. Facebook is not the web. Mark Zuckerberg is not the web. And to talk about media, you need somebody who has, in essence, rewritten McLuhanism. Is that a fair statement, Paul?
Absolutely. It's an eminently fair statement. I don't know if I've improved it, but I've definitely...
You've helped make it accessible.
I think so.
Yeah, because he was, using all the media of his time, including those that you could swallow, I dare say.
Yeah, he exulted in aphoristic, metaphoric statements, and that's
exactly
part of the joy of McLuhan.
It really is.
But, I try to write in a more prose way. I save my lyricism for my songs.
Yes. So who am you anyway? You're former president of the Science Fiction Writers of America, or I should say president emeritus is probably the better term, right?
I guess so.
Yeah. It's like my partner was not just a Nebula nominee. She is a finalist.
Right.
And that's a very, I've only heard that distinction recently.
Well, actually,
it's a very good one.
Well, technically, you shouldn't call yourself a nominee unless you are a finalist in terms of the rules of the organization.
That is correct.
Organization.
However,
right. A lot of people do anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
But
preliminary ballots are not really nominees. They haven't yet been nominated.
Well, when you're on the short list.
That's when you're on the short list,
okay.
Then you're not.
Anyhow, the point is that when you call yourself a nominee, that's sort of good until the banquet where they give the awards out.
Right.
After that, you were a nominee.
That's
you
right.
Are no longer a nominee.
That's right.
But you shall always be a finalist for that year.
That's true.
And that's the point, is that we can say that Barbara was a Nebula Award finalist.
Absolutely.
And
right.
Where to say that somebody was a nominee is like, yeah, okay,
it's
and
not
they,
as
you wash your
it lacks a certain pizzazz.
And it really does.
Yeah, I went through that crushing experience three times. That is, I was a finalist, and I heard in my mind's ear, I heard them say, and the winner is the Chronology Protection Case by Paul Levinson, but unfortunately that wasn't the reality.
Right.
So therefore, that was just a finalist,
not
a winner.
Yeah. So you've written three novels.
About seven.
I'm sorry, about...
Okay, you know.
That's right. How many in the time travel detective series?
Well, actually, there are two different series. The detective series, Dr. Phil D'Amato.
That's the one who
New
I
York
always
City
remember.
Friends.
Right.
You're not wrong, though, about the time travel, because his first story, not a novel, was the Chronology Protection case that
right.
I just mentioned. And Jay Kenzinger made a low-budget movie, but a great movie from that. So there are three novels.
Available on Amazon Prime.
Right, for free, actually, too, on Amazon Prime.
You have to be a member of Prime.
That's true.
So it's not for free. You pay $99 a year.
I agree. But listen, for the $99, you get free shipment on all your books.
Oh, there's a lot. There's a lot you get for that $99.
Yes.
And Amazon is making Amazon Prime the broadcast the video service.
That's right.
They're commercial sponsored.
That's
unless
right.
you are a paying member.
That's right. So you can see either The Man in the High Castle or The Chronology Protection Case. Which would you choose? But anyhow,
I happen to love The Man in the High
so
Castle.
Do I. So
it's not Philip. It's not Philip K. Dick.
Right.
It is more Electric Shepherd, who is one of his daughters, and all that. But it lives in his universe.
I agree completely. I love it. It's one of the best things I've ever seen on television.
It's very well done.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you react to the news of Amazon picking up something that they're calling The Lord of the Rings?
I had mixed feelings about that. Apropos,
mine aren't mixed at all, but
go on. Well, I'm trying to be generous because I try to keep an open mind, but...
I'm not saying it's going to be a bad show.
No, I know, but look, the movies, the trilogy was so spectacular that, I almost don't know if I can bring myself to watch a television series. But on the other hand, there's a whole history of people being surprised.
And we could have said, and I did say, that I couldn't bring myself initially to watch the movies.
Yeah.
What I told people is, okay, right now, pick up your Tolkien and read it one more time. Because right now the image of Frodo Baggins exists much, much better than it ever will in a movie.
Yeah.
Because your mind's eye of Mount Doom, of Sauron, of any of those images are better brought between the pen of John Ronald Reuel Tolkien and your mind's eye. And there is no special effect or actor or anything that can do a better job. And that's not to say that Elijah Wood wasn't wonderful or Ian McKellen or any of those people, that Peter Jackson did a very, very, very good adaptation job, although Peter S. Beagle's adaptation was not bad, but the less said about that movie, the better.
Right. Have you ever heard of my first love syndrome theory? No, you haven't. So let me tell you. This is a theory I've been developing over the years.
Okay.
And here's what the theory is. That when there are a variety of media presentations of narratives, book form, movie form, television form, what people love most is the form in which they first came to experience and fall in love. So that's why...
Well, I extend that a little. I also say that people have a tendency, like they think that the greatest blank movie that they ever saw was the one when they saw when they were 13.
Yeah, that's right. That speaks to that same point. I actually first realized that...
But sometimes those things are garbage.
Well, exactly. And I first
and
realized...
And best left not reread or reviewed or...
That's right. It wasn't at a science fiction convention. It was a class I was teaching in the late 1980s at the New School for Social Research. In fact, it was a master's level class, and we were talking about Star Trek. And I'll never forget this guy in the class said, well, as far as he's concerned, the best Star Trek that he ever saw was the first movie, which, as you know, is called Star Trek The Motion Sickness.
Not even Robert Wise, who directed that, would go along with that.
Exactly. And but I then...
Then know how old that person was. they were 12 or 13 when they saw that movie.
And he saw that movie before. He then went back and saw, you know, the original series, and then in those days, Star Trek The Next Generation.
Which came after.
Right. So it's a very powerful thing. You know,
although I saw the original series, and I remember when it was first broadcast and all that all too well. Gordon Van Gilder doesn't, because he was born the day it went on the air. But
I had no idea he was that young, Gordon.
Yeah, well, he's 51.
A mere child.
He's 51.
How do you like that?
And you know that because he was born September 8th.
That's very interesting. By the way, have you seen The Orville? Since we're
talking about, I haven't.
I highly recommend
it. I loathe and despise Seth MacFarlane.
Okay, well, give it a chance.
Maybe, but most likely, no.
It is funny, and it's true to the original spirit.
I have never heard anything come through the lips of Seth MacFarlane that even make me grin.
I'm not a Family Guy fan, but I'm telling you,
I am a loather.
Okay.
No, I mean, I really, really, really actively dislike the what he did to the Academy Awards the year that he hosted it. He's unfunny.
Yeah.
He's often unintelligent. He may be creative, but meh.
Are you familiar with I.A. Richards?
And anyhow, I'd like to finish the story I was telling.
Go ahead. I forgot.
I was in the middle of something, yes. I remember the day that the original Star Trek went on the air, having said that. And I know that there are some people my age, which says something about why it is their love, going along with this theory. Mm-hmm. My preferred version of Star Trek is Next Generation. Mm-hmm. I thought it was better written. I think that if Roddenberry had realized what he was doing would go beyond one broadcast and then a rerun during the summer, I think he would have been far more careful and done a much better job than he did. He was able to revise those issues for Next Gen, and he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't disagree with that. I think Next Gen, it's almost comparing apples and oranges, and there are certain individual episodes.
Some
of
apples
Next Gen
are juicier than others.
Yeah,
apples are juicier than some oranges.
That's true. Yesterday's Enterprise is one of the best shows ever, one of the best hours ever on television.
That and Measure of a Man are my two takeaways.
That's right. But on the other hand, City on the Edge of Forever is also a masterpiece. That's from the original series. You know, Hall and Ellison wrote.
Yeah, although it was edited.
It was. And
terribly.
Was,
and if people, by the way, want to hear the original, there is an audiobook version of the original.
Right.
With everybody from David Gerrold to Harlan doing the voices on it, available, I guess, on wherever you prefer to buy your audiobooks. Simply, The City on the Edge of Forever came out about a year ago.
Yeah, no, it's a great story. And look, The Trouble with Tribbles is classic comedy, you know.
It is.
So,
there's a whole lot to love about the original series, and it also broke the mold.
It did.
But when you get down to which had the better body of sophisticated science fiction, I'm afraid the answer is Next Gen. And after that, it only diluted.
I agree with you about that completely. Let me just say one quick thing in defense of The Orville and what you were saying about Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah.
I mentioned I.A. Richards. He was a literary theorist going back to the 1920s, and he came up with a whole bunch of principles, which he said people should try to follow when they judge. He was talking primarily about works of literature, but it applies to all popular culture. And one of the fallacies that Richards talked about was bringing anything that you might know about the author into your evaluation of the work,
mm-hmm.
because it's irrelevant. I mean, and that's what his
point
was.
And that is a very cogent argument
today
about separating the art and the artist.
Yeah.
Because there is so much. We want to separate ourselves from so many artists the last few months.
Exactly.
A couple of years going back to Cosby.
That's right. Who was the guy? I can't think of his name. He's in Ray Donovan. He plays Mickey. John Voight. Is that his name? I can't. The guy was in Midnight Cowboy.
John Voight.
John Voight. Okay.
But he was. I'm not aware that he was accused of anything. Dustin Hoffman.
He was not accused of anything. But this is even before people were accused. He is such an arch conservative that you know. I don't know how.
Well, a lot of my favorite performers are, but
I know. But that's neither that's here when nor I first there. Realized, you know, you know, when I see him on Ray Donovan, he plays Mickey Donovan. He puts in a fabulous performance, steals every scene that he's in. When I first started watching it, I was saying I shouldn't be liking this so much.
Yeah.
But what you're saying about, you know, the current sexual harassment is even more to the point.
It is. I mean, it depends on the content. When the content belies something that people are saying, I mean, you can find some of Wagner's anti-Semitism in the first act of Siegfried. It is right there for everybody to see, and it takes a skillful director, and there are skillful directors, to work their way around Mime and the anti-Semitism there.
Right.
And there is the other hand of saying that this is a German of the 1880s. And if you were even considered to be a Jew at that time, you became a Lutheran if you wanted to continue to work. Mahler, Mendelssohn. All these people were Jews who were forced to convert. It's the place and the era. But then there are the others, like Wagner, who were anti-Semites and proud of it.
Right.
And then, you know, you don't have to separate the art from the artist. You have to put the art in the context. When the offensive material is contained within the art, that's
another issue completely.
Yeah, exactly,
right.
Exactly.
Yes, that's right.
But yeah, I mean, I find it impossible to loathe the work of Kevin Spacey, who has done remarkable work. He's done remarkable things for the arts. He's saving, to a large extent, the Old Vic in London. And a brilliant, incredible actor, but apparently not that good a human being.
No, this is, and, you know, there's just no getting around it. You know, he did presumably certain things. He hasn't even denied it, so you don't even have to say presumably. But it is very...
Oh, he's one of the many who said he's getting therapy. Now, the difference is that he always presented to me a noble, wonderful character.
Right.
Whereas long before we, the viewers, as opposed to people in the industry, knew about the exploits of the exploitative Harvey Weinstein, we already knew that he was a creep of the highest water.
Right.
So in my opinion, one has to say that for anti-litigious purposes. And yet somebody put together, I think it was Quartz, which is a media outlet that does wonderful, wonderful coverage. And they put together a 2-minute video of of the Academy Awards, of just people saying, thank you, Harvey Weinstein, the most thanked man of the Academy Awards. And that is a fact.
Yeah.
And wow, that's scary.
Yeah. I mean, look, this has opened up the ugly underbelly of the entertainment industry. And
but we always knew it
was not known beforehand, but no one ever thought it was going to be in this.
People talked almost laughingly about the casting couch, going, you know, back to the 30s when... and then one has to take certain things into account. For example, Fatty Arbuckle was innocent, but he was driven out of the industry through slander and libel statements about him forcing himself on a woman or women and having a riotous party. It never happened. It never happened at all. He was driven out of the industry and could never get back in, even when it was exposed that it was all bad. Now, I'm not defending anybody currently. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that the stuff of scandal has always centered large first around Hollywood and second around politics.
Yeah, well, that's what Citizen Kane was all about.
Absolutely. You know, so, I didn't think of that, but of course.
Yeah. Well, look, anyone who is a celebrity or who, like Harvey Weinstein, makes celebrities become celebrities in many cases.
Well, he's a producer.
He's a producer.
It's a slightly different thing,
right.
But he does spend money,
right.
Put, you know, say, campaigning
right.
for people to win Academy Awards, and that
that's
money
right.
that he spent usually succeeded.
Right.
And that, he was a kingmaker.
Yeah.
He really was.
Yeah.
But he was, more than that, he was a great producer.
Yeah. But you, I mean, you would think, and, you know, obviously it's happened, you know, more than once, to say the least.
Oh, it's happened throughout history.
Right, that these people.
And people have known this.
That's right, would be especially careful because they're in the public eye. Because when you're a celebrity.
You would think.
You know, that means that, you know, unlike the average other person, no one is particularly interested in what that average other person is doing. You know, unless they actually commit, you know, crime out in public. But what goes on in private, most people aren't especially interested. But celebrities become celebrities precisely because they enjoy the fact that everyone is watching them, following them, looking at what
yes
they do.
Yes and so no. There are any number of celebrities who keep their lives very private and all that. What can you tell me about Amy Adams?
Yeah, well, that's
virtually
that's
nothing.
True. No, that's true. That, right.
Yeah, and right. and there you go.
Her life could suddenly become very well known because her name is out there.
She,
so far,
she chooses not
I
to.
Know.
It would take paparazzi.
Yeah.
It would take invaders who
right.
would be penalized for doing that because she can sue.
Yeah,
and she will. She, there have been incidents in which people published certain things about her, some of which were true, some of which were not, and bless her, she's dealt with those.
Yeah. But you probably know on that score that the defamation laws, at least here in the United States, tend to be much more forgiving about defamation to someone who's already a celebrity. It's almost as if you make a pact with society, in return for your fame, you have to accept that you're going to get extraordinary media coverage and even lies told
professor,
about you.
Does the law not say, and we should mention that Paul's a professor at Fordham University of, what is the actual title?
It's Fordham University, and it has campuses
but
in,
oh, no, of
well,
the
it's in New York City.
Professorship.
Communication and Media Studies.
Okay.
That's the title of my
professorship.
Okay.
That's what I was getting at. I knew what Fordham was.
Right.
But I also wanted to get out your credentials in this topic and why we're discussing that as opposed to your science fiction, which we will get to. But there is still such a thing as the expectation of privacy. And in the confines of one's home, if somebody's phone is tapped so that they can get information on where you're going to be, when you're taking your child to school, and things like that, that person, no matter how famed they are, be it Michael Jackson or whoever, and Jackson, of course, you know, craved all the publicity he could get for the most part. But that person has, and I believe this is the legal term, they have an expectation of privacy. And if that is, punctured?
Punctured is a good word.
If that is punctured, then they do have legal recourse.
Yes, that's right.
So just now, if on the other hand, you act like a jerk in a hotel room during a film shoot going on, even if it's off hours, with somebody involved in that film shoot, And especially if what you are doing is something that breaks the law, that's another story.
Yeah, well, I agree completely. And obviously everyone is entitled to privacy on that level.
But the paparazzi don't know that.
The paparazzi don't know that, but I'm saying something slightly different.
Okay.
That these celebrities obviously only have themselves to blame for doing what they did. But in addition to that, they were stupid.
Well, non-celebrities have only themselves to blame.
Everybody
for
has only
transgression.
Yes, okay. But my point is,
I mean, I love it when I get on a bus and you hear the recording. Bus drivers are protected by law. Remember that assaulting a bus driver is a felony. And I'm thinking, but what if I'm assaulted?
Right.
Is that not a felony? Come on.
But the difference on that score is if the bus driver is assaulted while he or she is driving, that could hurt a lot of people.
And if
only you're assaulted, some of your listeners
matter,
might be disappointed. But
except for the fact that I'm a WBAI host.
But anyway, let's not talk anymore.
Let's change that. But I will say that I am as minor a celebrity as anyone will find for hosting a middle of the night or early in the morning radio program and all that. And here on Facebook Live, I have been stalked. And I don't deserve that.
No, I agree. No one deserves to be stalked. So I'm not talking about stalking.
But
I'm just saying that celebrities should understand.
I have been stalked for the sole reason that I am a quasi-celebrity.
Right.
Only because somebody has heard me on the air.
Right.
I've had my life threatened because of a song I played.
What song was that?
The Sinking of the USS Titanic by Jamie Brockett.
Huh, I don't even know that song.
It's fun. You'd probably like it.
All right.
And I have no idea what was offensive in it, but
maybe you should have played.
But
the
person was
Edna
a nut.
Fitzgerald.
Might have done the same thing, but it's sung better. But no, the Jamie Brockett song is fun. Pardon me.
It's okay.
But yes, let us change the topic.
Yeah.
How many nonfiction books have you out there?
Well, actually, let me just go back and say, I mentioned the three Phil DeMotto novels.
Okay, yes.
Okay?
So let's finish.
And then my
time
travel trilogy, The Plot to Save Socrates, Unburning Alexandria, and Chronica. And then there's one other novel, Borrowed Tides, about the first starship, Alpha Centauri, which, by the way, that was published in 2001. And in that novel, a planet is discovered around Proxima Centauri, which is not the main star. It's like a little, it's part of a cluster. There's Alpha Centauri A and B. And anyway, just in the last year or two, the Hubble and other telescopes have picked up a possible planet there. So I might have gotten luckily prescient in that novel.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so those are my seven novels. My nonfiction is, my very first book was actually a collection of essays about Karl Popper, a British philosopher who actually was Austrian. And he suddenly become very relevant because of what people say is the paradox of tolerance, which Popper did talk about, in which he said, Popper, that even free speech should have limitations. We should try to...
Oh, we were arguing about this off air.
That's right. Stop speech that wants to destroy free speech.
Who was the writer at the Village Voice?
Nat Hentoff.
Oh, my God.
He was brilliant.
Brilliant writer.
I love Nat Hentoff.
But
I agree with him completely. You
did. I did not. I felt that he was an extremist in the name of free speech.
I think you have to be an extremist because, and this is the problem with Popper's paradox of tolerance. As soon as you say, certain kinds of speech, those are too dangerous.
See, this is why I told
allow.
You to stay away from the microphone. You didn't pop your piece, but on
all
Popper's
right.
Anyway.
Okay, good point. Popper is basically a pee popper for microphones.
Yes.
No doubt about it. So when I say popper, I should basically just turn.
No, you're fine because you're looking. As people on Facebook Live can see, you are using the mic properly.
Well, good. See, well, you're a good teacher.
Yeah. But anyway, I will say, however, careful of this table because these stupid mic stands are attached to the table. And
so, got it. All right. So I'll try
people at home can hear that.
Yeah, I'll gesture without banging. Anyway, so In Pursuit of Truth was a collection of essays I put together on Karl Popper. Then I had a book called Electronic Chronicles, another book called Learning Cyberspace. But my first book that really attracted a lot of attention is called The Soft Edge, A Natural History and Future of the Information Revolution. It's been translated into about 15 languages, including, by the way, in China. And I have a feeling I'm better known in China than I am here in the United States. You know, you talk about celebrity. Because, for example, I now have a wonderful...
Michael Swanwick has discovered that trail himself as well.
I have a wonderful visiting scholar from China, Yidan Chin. Who knows, Yidan may be watching me right now on Facebook.
Or he may be watching you in the future on Facebook.
That's right. But... every term I get email from a Chinese scholar saying we'd love to come and study with you. Anyway, so that was The Soft Edge. Then came Digital McLuhan, which is where I talked extensively about McLuhan. Then I had a book called Real Space on the Fate of Physical Presence on and Off Planet. Then a book called Cell Phone, before there were even smartphones. Then a book called New Media. And very recently...
I mentioned before we went on the air, we're doing new media this morning.
That's right.
But I'll explain that later.
I know. Yeah, well, I actually...
New Media Squared.
Yeah, I was thinking of entitling my next book New Media, but it would be GNU... N-U,
Wildebeest, yes.
Right, N-E-W Media. So new...
So Wildebeest, so right. New Media.
How about some media here? Anyhow, and then most recently, I have a really more of an essay, but it's available as a book on Amazon called Fake News in Real Context, which I constantly update because it's a continuing story.
Yeah.
So those are my science fiction and nonfiction books.
Yeah. The First Amendment thing is the old shouting theater in a crowded fire.
That's
as
right.
Abby Hoffman.
Which I thought was a terrible decision. And this is an interesting thing. Historically, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. in that 1919 decision, this guy Schenck was distributing anti-war leaflets close to a draft station.
Yeah.
And this was 1919, and Holmes was a great believer in the First Amendment, and he wanted to protect the First Amendment from society and other justices who would have been all too happy to rip it apart. So he thought that if he established, there are some things that the First Amendment doesn't allow, such as, by the way, it's falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater.
I was quoting Abby Hoffman.
I know.
Quote, shouting theater in a crowded fire was actually the quote.
I know that. But most people tend to just say shouting fire in a crowded theater. Even Holmes wasn't that bad. If you're in a crowded theater and there's a fire somewhere, maybe it would be a good idea to let people know about it. It's falsely shouting fire. That's the malicious thing that can lead to people getting trampled. Anyway, so he and Justice Louis Brandeis, another great advocate of the First Amendment, got together and came up with this decision. And then every year that went by afterwards, they both bitterly regretted it because they discovered to their chagrin that they had opened the door by saying the First Amendment is not absolute. They opened the door for all manner of government attempts to try to control the First Amendment.
And ongoing.
That's right.
And constant. There were years in which this radio station was afraid to rebroadcast Howl. We created that broadcast. Right. But there is the other side of the argument. We were talking before in the pub.
Right.
We were talking about the Carlin decision, which of course affected us gravely, and the establishment, and for people who don't know their history, but I see that one of our station managers from before my time is actually watching us on Facebook now. Hi, Chris and Max. These people know this stuff better than I. They've really lived it.
Yeah.
We were not found guilty of going past the First Amendment. We were fined for abrogating responsibility and showing an irresponsible behavior as a broadcaster to the public because of the time of day.
Right. It was 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. However, as you know from our discussion.
Okay, but go ahead, I was putting that aside.
Okay.
I was saying aside from that point, and I'm just stating that this is why we were found guilty.
Right.
People think that we were told you can't have the First Amendment. No, the Supreme Court agreed that we have the First Amendment. We have the rights of the First Amendment, but one has to show responsibility in broadcasting. And so the choice of time of day for that broadcast is what we were found guilty of. So all that aside.
What were you saying? I think it was a very bad decision. I disagree with that completely, and it does violate the First Amendment. You know, it doesn't not violate the First Amendment to say what I'm doing doesn't violate the First Amendment. The fact of the matter is, and this comes from Hugo Black, it comes from William Douglas, two great justices that were appointed by FDR, and I think it was Hugo Black who said, and Douglas agreed completely, no law means no law. Congress shall make no law. That's the wording of the First Amendment.
That is the exact wording. Congress shall make no law abridging
freedom of speech or of the press.
Or religion.
Yeah, that's good. Right. So the fact of the matter is, there are people.
What really annoys me is you go to the museum near the mall in D.C., and they have like only one very, very, very small section dedicated to the First Amendment and talks mostly about religion.
Yeah, that's part of the problem.
They don't want to talk about the news and about language.
That's right. There have only been two times in the 20th century, in my view, where the Supreme Court made a really major decision. Well, maybe more than two times.
I was going to say.
Times versus Sullivan is an important decision. But, the Pentagon Papers, that is a wonderful landmark decision in which the Supreme Court says to Nixon unanimously, no, you can't stop the Washington Post and the New York Times from publishing. And then in the mid-1990s, the Supreme Court did strike down the Communications Decency Act, which, by the way, Bill Clinton signed into law, even though he said he didn't agree with it. Because he claims he was hoping the Supreme Court would strike it down. A better strategy on his part would have been just to veto it. But in any case, other than those few examples, beginning with the Clear and Present Danger decision in 1919, the Supreme Court has systematically weakened First Amendment protections. And they always seem to do it for similar reasons, apropos of the George Carlin WBAI.
Because they're strengthening other federal departments.
Well, yeah, and they're worried, about obscenity. They're worried about indecent material.
That is correct. The language, because obscenity had already been through the Supreme Courts thanks to James Joyce all kinds of issues, and they weren't going to bring that up. They couldn't bring that up anymore.
Right.
But the language of the FCC today, somewhere in this room, is a list of the seven words that you cannot say. First of all, that list isn't accurate.
Well, far more than seven.
The list, the Carlin list, is not accurate.
In what way? You can't say those words?
I can say that I'm pissed off about something.
Okay.
And I just said one of the seven words.
Okay.
I can say that any time of day.
Okay, fair enough.
People have to remember that was not the FCC list.
Right.
That was not the list by the Supreme Court. That was the list by George Carlin.
That's right.
It's okay.
But the Supreme Court ratified, even though that was not a word that was forbidden,
the case,
the Supreme Court should have basically sent the FCC packing
and said,
the FCC, have no right under the First Amendment to tell any radio station whatsoever, any time of day or night, what to broadcast and what not. And in fact,
I believe you will read that that is in the decision.
Well, it is in the decision, but that's in effect what they did. It had a chilling effect. You yourself were telling me just before the show that we can't say certain words.
You don't know who it is that is preventing us from saying those words.
All right.
It's not the Supreme Court, and it's not the FCC.
Well, who is it, Pacifica?
It is.
Okay, because Pacifica doesn't want to have an adverse decision.
Pacifica doesn't want to have to pay to go to court.
Exactly, but they shouldn't have to go to court. It should be thrown out of court.
Shouldn't have to.
Yes. But
and whatever that, are so moot. The point is that they may not be guilty. They may be in the right.
Right.
But to go to court costs millions upon millions of dollars.
Right. And my point is that's a form of censorship. And it's because of the Supreme Court's decision in the George Carlin case. And there are other deleterious decisions.
The funny thing is that it actually opened the gates for broadcasters like CBS, PBS, and BBS, and all that. It made it clear that there were times when they could do things. And before that, they were not able to do things.
Here's how that is actually operating right now.
It was a chill on us because we're unfunded.
Not just on you, on everyone.
Yeah, chill on.
I'll give you an example. 2017, my wife and I are watching and enjoying a series called The Collection. By the way, I highly recommend it, even though it's not science fiction.
Ooh, Mike Leier. Hi, Mike.
Yeah. And it's about the fashion industry in Paris right after World War II.
I've heard of it. Yeah. I haven't watched it.
Really delightful show, very different kind of show. Anyway, here's my point. We were watching the show, and basically there were words this is PBS. It was a British show. There are words that are bleeped out. When women and men are taking off their clothes, it's blurred out. The show is shown, I don't know, like 10 o'clock at night on Sunday. It's violating idiotic
It's within
concern.
Safe harbor.
Yeah, some child will see it.
On the other hand, don't move too far away from the mic.
Okay. So this is basically what the Supreme Court, with the George Carlin decision and their other lousy decisions, have wrought. And it's not only that decision, it's what happened with the Janet Jackson incident.
Michael Powell
basically, so he saw a woman's breast for a split second.
Yeah, and by the way, for the record, the people who defended CBS on that case were the same people who defended us on Carlin, for the record.
Right.
Same. They were made famous.
Right.
By us.
Yeah, well, okay.
More power to them. I think they lost a lot of money directly because of us and made millions of dollars as a result of having done as well as anybody could have done with that particular case. No, you're absolutely right. There is no reason why something that has, by the way, been deemed acceptable and broadcast in England.
That's right.
You know, people are not that different on this side of the pond.
Right.
But the difference is the sponsor. And here I get on the high stool of listener-sponsored radio to say the sponsor of PBS is Congress.
Yeah.
It's politicians. And we have already seen Jesse Helms and like-minded politicians try to defund all of, as they say, try to take money away from showing Big Bird.
Right.
And I do believe that there have been instances in which the government owned and run broadcast outlets of this country. The BBC has a very interesting makeup with governors and Ofcom, is it? There's some kind of an agency that monitors the monitors, as it were.
Right.
And they cover a whole lot of stuff, including consumer affairs and things like that. They're sort of like a people's ombudsman kind of thing. We don't have any such thing. PBS and NPR, and to a very, very limited extent, Pacifica all benefit from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which, as you hear all the time on TV, they say a public corporation. The word public means owned and operated by the United States government. And if those people are going to be funded, they have to choose who they are going to fund and for the people that they fund, the organizations that they fund. People have to be very, very careful. Therefore, they spent, $1.5 million dollars when they made the PBS logo deciding on whether the face would face left or face right. And
should have had it like Janice, face two ways.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
That's a shame. But by the way, I know I agree.
We're not talking about Chaplin, by the way. We're talking about the God.
That's right.
No, the God.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The Roman God. There's no doubt.
Coming your way in 2 months, January.
Yeah. The funding by the government of anything, whether it's broadcasting or anything, is making a deal with the devil. Not that I'm some kind of libertarian, you know, against the government, but what the government gives, the government can take away.
And yet the BBC more or less manages to remain free, more or less. I would say,
yes.
I would say 98%.
98. There are a couple better than us, but you know, there is the example of the Falklands Malvino War.
Yes.
And you probably heard about that, where Margaret Thatcher ordered the BBC to stop its coverage.
Well, Margaret Thatcher was also a special case.
Yes, she was.
She was the Ronald Reagan.
That's right.
The difference is that Reagan is media savvy.
Yeah.
When he had his mind.
Yeah.
Which wasn't for the full term of his presidency, in my opinion. But at any rate, the
that's not true. I always had my mind.
I'll tell you a story about that off air. Okay. But the going way back, I had some other cogent thing about my problem with not having some kind of protection is the problem not necessarily of what people consider profane or obscene. And by the way, it's very interesting. Profanity is legal. Obscenity is not legal. And the only problem is that they can't define obscenity.
Right.
Other than that one great, possibly apocryphal quote to Holmes, I think it was.
No, not Holmes. It was Brennan in
the 1960s. Justice Brennan.
It's not apocryphal. He basically said, everyone knows it when they see it or hear it.
Thinking of a different one.
Oh, okay.
A different quote.
All right.
Which is, he said, this definitely is obscene. People said, how could you tell? He said, it gave me an erection.
Okay, no, that's not the point. So that's not Brennan, as far as I know.
No, I think it's Holmes.
Okay, maybe Holmes.
But it may be apocryphal.
I thought Holmes was more of a gentleman.
I said, apocryphal.
Came from a different era.
Yes.
Hard to...
But my problem is with hate speech.
Okay.
My problem is that you can get somebody in front of a microphone like this, or YouTube. On YouTube, they have had beheadings. They have had beckoning people to join hate groups, to come to rallies, to burn crosses, to loathe Jews, to whatever. And this is where I always differed with the purist, the genius purist, Nat Hentoff. He was both.
Right.
And I think you'll agree with that, that he was a genius and a purist.
I'll just say, I'm certainly a purist. That's why I agreed with Hentoff 100%.
And my caveat, I will not say I disagree. Yeah. I will say, this is what scares me about that.
Yeah. No, I know. Look, the hate speech is a serious problem, but this, here is a paraphrase, not an exact quote. Louis Brandeis said, the remedy to hate speech, or whatever word he used, is not to censor it, but to have more speech that denounces it. And that gets back to John Milton's Areopagitica, if you have a fundamental confidence, you know, human beings aren't perfect. Human beings are subject to being swayed by their emotions. Human beings do all kinds of stupid and bad things. But most human beings have a fundamental rationality. And if you allow, and this gets back to Milton, if you keep the gates open and you allow truth as well as falsity to get into the marketplace of ideas, most people sooner or later will be able to separate it. So suppressing hate speech is not going to stop it. The best way of stopping it is to show it for what it is. And that's certainly what Nat Hentoff thought. That's what I think. And it doesn't hurt that Matt Hentoff was also a great jazz journalist.
Yeah, no, it doesn't hurt at all. We have one of the great jazz journalists on Facebook right now.
A
former station manager who wrote the definitive book on Bessie Smith to the point where we probably wouldn't remember her name if it wasn't for him. And stuff that he did on WBAI, as I said, a former station manager of this radio station. Well, a controversial figure in no small way. I think you'll agree with that, Chris.
I'm happy to meet you, Chris.
Yeah. So at any rate, I think now's the time for a musical break. When we come back, we should talk about that skiffy stuff.
Good.
Skiffy being a fondly derogatory term for sci-fi, because there are purists.
They don't like sci-fi.
Exactly. Right. Thank you.
It should be SF if you're going to abbreviate it. That's acceptable.
The term sci-fi historically, we just dropped our internet connection.
Okay.
But it's trying to reconnect, and we will hope that it will.
Good.
But the feed here, the Wi-Fi here really sucks. So,
that word is acceptable.
It is. Because as you say, it's not about the words. It's about indecency.
Right.
It is. That is the FCC language about what you can not broadcast. Right. Okay. We came back up. Yeah, it's our signal is... goes in and out because the Wi-Fi here at WBAI goes in and out. And when we lose the Wi-Fi, we lose the Facebook signal because I'm using a camera, a smartphone, in order to bring you these images. It's a darn good smartphone. And it's not attached to Ethernet of any kind. Right. We actually don't have Ethernet connections here. We just have Wi-Fi.
It's part of the charm of the operation.
Yeah, it's part of being broke, is what it is. We're lucky to be in a building where the owner is a member of the movement. So,
good.
You know,
I'm glad.
So we do have a very good home here, I must say. At any rate, the term sci-fi was coined by... Forrest J. Ackerman.
Okay. Right.
In his magazine, Famous Monsters of Filmland. And he coined the term in order to refer to what I think today is called kaiju. That's a monster, but the kind of cinema that featured kaiju, Godzilla, grade B movies.
Right. Them.
Them is sci-fi.
The incredible shrinking man.
Is sci-fi.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that.
Whereas Forbidden Planet is actually science fiction.
That's right.
Star Wars is sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's really science fantasy.
It's sophisticated sci-fi.
Have to be bad.
No, you're right.
It doesn't have to be bad.
Well, are you kidding? Them wasn't bad.
That's right.
The incredible shrinking man wasn't bad. For that matter, the original Fly... with Vincent Price was a great movie, crazy movie.
I'm not sure that isn't science fiction / horror.
Maybe.
I'm not sure if that's sci-fi because...
As a serious... that's true.
It's
not just bug-eyed monsters.
Because we are splitting hairs here.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's not just a BEM that landed.
True.
So science fiction fans of the 50s and 60s used very creatively and very well the terms sci-fi versus SF, for to abbreviate it, or spec fic. And here's a quiz question. The term speculative fiction was coined by?
Theodore Sturgeon.
No, you're close. You're closer than you think. No, we just lost our signal again.
Philip K. Dick?
No. It was the 40s. I'll tell you that. Heinlein. Heinlein coined the term speculative fiction, and ironically, he coined it to mean fiction that speculated in the reality and truth of science.
The
definition today has very much changed.
Speculative fiction today is a sort of softer, more humanistic form of science fiction. In other words, to some extent, it's science fiction. Usually nowadays in the 21st century is harder than what speculative fiction suggests.
Yeah. We went out again. Sorry, Facebook people, by powers beyond our control. So at any rate, when journalists started simply abbreviating science fiction into sci-fi, thinking that it was merely an abbreviation, there were those of us who had been talking about SF and sci-fi and fantasy and all of these grouped and horror, all of these as different parts of one large genre of which sci-fi was very distinct from science fiction, and that SF is the abbreviation for science fiction. For years and years, I was peeing into the wind trying to explain to people, no, they're not the same thing. They are different. But now, Gravity's Rainbow is not sci-fi.
No,
I'm sorry.
Right.
It just isn't.
That's
it is science fiction.
That's right.
Thomas Pynchon writes science fiction. I would say it's closer to speculative fiction than science fiction. But he wrote science fiction. But to say that Thomas Pynchon writes sci-fi is a slap in the face.
Yeah. Well, I agree.
An unknown face, but nonetheless. and so that's why us purists on that score, we have history behind us, the history of the terminology.
Right.
But it's moot. It's absolutely moot. So we're going to play some music and remind you that you're tuned to Listener Sponsored, WBAI in New York City. At 99.5 FM over WBAI.org and Facebook Live intermittently. And here is some music by an unknown performer. composer and lead singer.
That's right. Take a rain check, please don't stay. Save all your loving for a sunny day.
And from the album Twice Upon a Rhyme, correct, which is noted, has an E next to, I would say, two-thirds of the songs, a big red E, meaning entertaining.
Oh, well, thank you. That's great.
That's
great review.
They may mean explicit.
Okay.
But
what? No, there's nothing explicit in those songs. It's just pure poetry.
But pure poetry.
Yeah.
Some of the best of it is,
that's true.
I mean, Howell.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some of the best minds of my generation. Yeah. Anyway, this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My guest is Paul Levinson, professor at Fordham University, science fiction writer, professor of media, author of many books about media. Oh, God, there's so much more I'd like to talk to you about media today, including like this new form that we have. I've been obsessing over the kinds of serials in which somebody writes a novel and then they set stories within the context of the novel, but they don't do the story that the novelist wrote. Instead, they run around in that universe taking advantage of the world building that has been done for them. Mm-hmm. With the difference of, the TV series, which we both agree is excellent, Man in the High Castle, is not the story of Philip K. Dick wrote.
No.
It is the universe and some of the characters.
Right. It's the package.
Right.
Right. And but the contents of the package are different.
Yeah. And whereas on the other hand, the TV series The Magicians, another show that I enjoy a great deal based on the trilogy by Lev Grossman, is following the story, but in a very different creative way. And characters are taken out, new characters are put in, but they're still running around in the universe, coming up with very much their own story.
Right.
And that's a whole other thing that I've read some of your extremely entertaining blogs, many of which I've quoted and held to my chest, and some of which I've yelled at you so that you could hear it right through the computer screen that I was reading them on. But always entertaining, always interesting stuff.
I'm glad to hear that.
Now, I would be very happy to discuss that stuff and take listener calls, if any, or have you read your fiction. It's your call.
All right. I do want to read a little of my fiction, okay?
Okay.
And because this, you know, I want to do something for this show that no one, including my...
Okay, excuse me to our listener, Deb. No, he's not a filker. A filk song writer is somebody who takes somebody else's already created songs and assigns them to science fiction stories. He's a folk song writer and performer. Not, he's a folky, not a filker.
All right. That's okay, Debbie.
Deborah.
Okay. So I'm going to do something. I'm going to read not that much of a brand new story. I've never done this before. The story isn't even completed. It's not even partially done. And before I read it, I'll tell you that I got the idea because I was at an unveiling. And people of the Jewish faith will know what an unveiling is. A year after, someone is laid to rest at a cemetery, the family comes back and unveils the tombstone, literally. And I'll begin. The name of the story is Robinson Calculator.
And please state for the broadcast is copyright, but for the sake of the Facebook, please say that it is copyright Paul Levinson.
Okay.
2017.
Okay, so this is Robinson Calculator, copyright Paul Levinson, 2017. And again, I enthusiastically...
Ellison would never forgive you if you didn't do that.
Okay, give my permission for this to be broadcast all over the known and unknown universe.
Yes, but you see, not copied.
Okay.
That's the issue.
All right, good point. All right, here we go. I first noticed the name on a headstone in the Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. Robinson Calculator. I mean, would they be so blatant to name themselves by that name and bury one of themselves under a tombstone which plainly identified the deceased as Calculator? That would bring hiding in plain sight to a whole new level. I'm not making this up. You'd see this with your own eyes if you were in the right spot in the cemetery. I'd understand if you didn't. Most people are only visiting the cemetery because they're grieving for a loved one. But sometimes there's less grief than others. You know, for family, for a member of the family by marriage, you didn't really know the old guy all that well. And if there were no tears in your eyes and you looked in the right place, trust me, you'd see that name incised in stone, too. Robinson Calculator. I've been tracking those people for years, though obviously they're not really people. And the sight of that name on the headstone was a shard of worrisome ice in my heart, because it meant they didn't care anymore, didn't worry about who saw them or who knew about them. Now, I have nothing against them. In fact, I like them. They have spunk and style. My friend, a college buddy, had even been married to one, though she didn't use her maiden name. I chuckled to myself. Maiden doesn't seem quite right for a calculator, does it? Doesn't seem quite right for anyone anymore. But, you know, I like this calculator that my buddy had been married to. Hell, more than that, I'd wanted her. I had mixed feelings when they broke up. Dave and Laura had planned on adopting, but he had become increasingly obsessed with seeing his DNA come to life in a new being. And, of course, there was no way that could happen with Laura. I'd been on the verge of contacting her a bunch of times in the few years since they'd split, but seeing that name on the headstone provided new impetus. Now, just to be clear, I know that people have all kinds of last names derived from real objects, and I don't think for a minute that the holders of names derived from objects are endowed with the physical properties of their names. I mean, no one looked for gold or water when they saw Barry Goldwater, though for all I knew he sported a gold ring or watch, and his body was certainly whatever percent water like all human beings. Hey, there was a girl by the name of Samantha Sugar in my high school bio class, and I didn't think she was literally sweet, though she did have a sweet smile when she wanted to show it, and a sweet ass, too, in those cotton jeans. But the calculators, they were something else. The name apparently originated in Europe as far back as the golem and the real automata that preceded the mythical golem by centuries. Heron of ancient Alexandria constructed automata far earlier, though there is no surviving evidence that he called them calculator as a last name or called them anything at all. And anyway, they mostly had only one name back then, right? But the calculators, they were different. Whenever they originated, they started life as a family, a big family, with aunts and uncles as well as parents and children. And the family grew. I texted Laura Calculator, "How are you doing?" "Watching Battlestar Galactica," she replied. "Never gets old." Figured, "How about lunch in the next few days? Blue Ribbon Sushi on Sullivan Street?" I knew she lived in the village and worked at home. I also knew Dave, her former husband, hated sushi, and she loved it. "Sure," she replied. "How does Thursday work for you?" I ordered the big orange clam, and she ordered the sweet ebi. We talked for a few minutes about inconsequential things. Then she took my hand. "I'm not yet ready for anything more than friendship," she said. Okay, I said. I know you're the kind of guy who thinks if she doesn't want my dick, she doesn't want my soul, but... My mouth hung open. I filled it with a piece of clam. I guess that's what they mean by spunk. Do you think I have a soul? She shifted focus. I mean, seriously. What, in a religious sense? I sipped some sencha tea, grateful for the change of topic. I'm not sure I know what that means. If it's something that God breathed into us, well, I guess I'm agnostic. If it's just a word for what my brain contains, then sure, I think you're my mental equal. I wouldn't think you were any different from me at all. In fact, if your name were not Calculator, she said. Yeah, I said. Why do you use it? It's the law, Laura replied. I laughed. What law would that be? Most people don't even know you exist. Common law, Laura said. It goes back centuries. Ah, okay, I said. It's some kind of profound, deeply embedded custom. She gave me a look. I don't know if I'd call it profound. She bit into one of the crunchy fried shells of her shrimp, which had been served to her so quickly that its appearance on our table almost seemed surreptitious. But it's an important custom, I said. She nodded and crunched away. Who came up with it? Was it imposed on you? I asked her. She cleared her palate and throat with tea. We did. Why are you suddenly so interested? I told her about the Robinson calculator in the cemetery. Never heard of him, she said, and summoned the waiter. I'll have another EB. I'm fine, I said to the waiter. And to Laura, do you know all the calculators? Now she laughs. Of course not. Do you know all the human beings? Her laughter sounded like rain. I like rain. The Beatles song, that Beatles song with John Lennon singing lead, has always been one of my favorites. I assume there aren't as many humans as calculators, right? I said and summoned another waiter. More tea, please. I looked at Laura, who nodded for both of us. The waiter bowed quickly and left. No, Laura said. We aren't as numerous as humans. She said this in slow, mocking, exaggerated terms. But I doubt you know anything close to the names of every human, even in your neighborhood or your block. I nodded. And the only reason you know about me and my kind is I was married to your friend Dave, Laura added. The original waiter returned with Laura's EB and a pot of tea. He refilled our cups. Anything more? He asked politely. I shook my head no. When do you think your people made a decision to put one of their names on such a publicly viewable tombstone? I asked Laura. She considered for a moment. I don't know that they did. I mean, I believe you about what you saw on that tombstone, but I don't know if that was the result of a decision by the calculators. I looked down for a moment at my tea. The pale green liquid seemed to shimmer in my cup as if, I don't know, in response to some soft sound wave. Then I realized there was sound in the room, or at least at our table. Laura was singing, and somehow she was singing all the parts to the song, all the harmony, so softly that only I could hear. I looked around at the people at the other tables. They couldn't hear her. It was like I was wearing earbuds and Laura was the phone. It was beautiful. B.J. Thomas's Rock and Roll Lullaby. And Laura was singing it just for me. My father had loved that song, especially those Blossom and Beach Boy harmonies. He'd sung more than half of those harmonies as we walked the beach on the bay side of Cape Cod. I know I never told Laura about that. I doubt I even told Dave. Laura smiled at me and stopped singing. I researched you, she said. After I texted you about lunch? No, after the first time I met you when I was still with Dave, she replied. Now I smiled. She was very distracting. You think we human beings put the name calculator on that headstone, I asked her. I wanted to stay focused. Laura sucked on her EB sushi, her eyes closed in appreciation. Sha-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, it'll be all right. She obviously didn't want to discuss this. I sipped my tea. She sang a little more. Then she suddenly said, it all became public in the 1920s. It all began to change with R.U.R. Carol Capek's play, Rossum's Universal Robots? Yeah, Laura said. That's when robots first entered our popular culture in a big way. It got Asimov going. It got Data going. It got humans. It got Westworld. Everything else follows from Capek. Did Capek know about you? I asked Laura. About the calculators? I don't know. I wasn't alive back then. It occurred to me that I did not know anything about calculator lifespans. How exactly old are you, I mean? She squeezed my hand. I had touched her hand before and knew it was warm, but for some reason I was a little surprised by its warmth anyway. I enjoyed this, she said, and suddenly stood. How much do I owe you? She fished for her credit card. The waiter had yet to bring the bill. On me, I said, but I hope I didn't offend you with anything I said. You didn't, she said, and kissed me on the lips to prove it. I believed her and thought, well, Dave was even more of a fool than I thought he'd been to leave her. I watched her walk to the front of the restaurant. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, well, she sure walked like a woman.
Robinson Calculator, read for you by the author, Paul Levinson.
Number. You know my name.
Up the number. It's 99.5 FM. The name is Jim Freund and Paul Levinson on Hour of the Wolf. And yes, I do take great pride in trying to match songs to stories. Was that or Rain?
That was great.
Those,
you know
those,
my name, you know my number. That was brilliant.
Look up the number.
Right.
This is, however, very strangely, the only versions that they seem to have available on my musical source are the remastered songs.
I know,
songs.
That's the way it is with a lot of them.
I loathe.
I know that.
All they do to remaster them
I know.
Is they add echo.
I agree completely.
Echo and reverb.
Right.
They don't bring out, they muddy the original.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
And folks, when I play Steel Eye Span and other groups on this radio show, I'm going back to my collection of CDs and stuff like that. I do not use, and even then, some of the later CDs of reissues are, quote, remastered. I stay away. They sully. I think that I found like one song I thought was better.
Yeah, well, you played the original Twice Upon a Rhyme track
well,
before, so there you go.
Yes,
they haven't remastered those.
If you like, I could remaster it for you.
No,
all I have to do is put it into reverb.
That's right.
It's so easy to remaster.
Yeah.
Is it Kopic or Tropic?
What are we talking about?
The writer, the author of RUR.
Oh, I pronounce it K-Pec, but I could be...
K-Pec. I always assumed,
right. Yeah.
And I should ask my mother, who lived right. in Czechoslovakia for so many years, when there was a Czechoslovakia.
Right.
I've always assumed it was Carl, you know,
right.
Carl Rule,
right.
but Carl
right.
Chopek, because somewhere there's some
might be right. you
kind
might be
of
right.
weird accent mark.
There is a weird accent mark over the A.
That's it. Over
but
the A.
Yeah.
But that ought to really change. I'll have to ask Stefan
yeah.
Rudnicki.
Yeah.
Who I work with
yeah.
on the Lightspeed and Nightmare podcasts.
Good names for podcasts.
Oh.
I'm serious.
We got two Hugo Awards.
Yeah.
I am the host of the Lightspeed and I'm the audio editor for both. And I've done about 20 audiobooks with them so far.
Good.
Edited. I've produced two, but I've edited a whole bunch. So, Lister, you're here. Hallelujah. I don't have to worry about you're not getting here. You're half an hour late last week because you chose to take the worst subway. Is it the Q? Is it the Q that you take?
Listen, any in my
of the
opinion,
three,
any subway that you take is the worst subway. They
at this, especially at this hour. So get undressed and
okay.
get comfortable. You haven't seen this particular act, Paul, but this is you know an actor prepares. This is a broadcaster for.
I like this.
Prepares.
That's very good. I feel like I'm really on the inside here.
Lister was what were you producer for Island Records in Haiti?
Executive
A&R
person.
A&R.
Yeah.
Wow.
A&R
okay.
is very important.
So
you decide.
So no, I thought it was Island Records.
Island Records.
Oh, it is. So that and that's an imprint of
A&R.
They're
a big company.
Yeah. So, and now he has risen above that horrible existence to be on the air from 3 to 5 a.m. on WBAI with Burn Baby Burn Clappers. Everybody, stay tuned. Okay, why don't you put on your headphones, Paul?
Okay. Island girl.
Okay, be very careful, because we've got liquid near microphones.
Okay, so I'm going to move this liquid out of
the microphone. Those of you watching on Facebook, I don't think you're going to hear the phone calls. I don't know what to do about that other than listen to the rebroadcast. Okay, let's see. Bring these up, and good morning, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hello, fine.
Yeah.
Deb.
Hi, Deb.
How
I can barely hear her.
Oh, okay. You have a volume switch if you follow
okay.
the cable.
Okay.
You're on the air, so talk to the listeners. You have a question for Paul
okay.
or something?
Okay. First off, hi, Paul. It's great to finally put a face to the name after all our Goodreads talk. Love your D'Amato books, as you know.
Well, thank you.
And looking forward to you seeing more of them. Jim.
Is there going to be more in the way of D'Amato?
Yes, I'm working on a new novel right now, actually.
Okay.
So in the next year or two.
Yes, Deborah.
Yay. God, how many homes? This is a silly question, I guess. How many homes has BAI had since the church?
Since the church, well, before the church, there was 30 East 39th Street. Then there was the church on 62nd and 1st.
Which
then
is
there was
where you and I met it in Oregon.
Right. And then the WBAI, then we went to 505 8th Avenue, then to 120 Wall Street, then to CUNY up on 138th Street in Harlem, and now at 388 Atlantic Avenue. So those
wow.
are, so I wasn't counting, but those are the addresses.
Wow. I only have one gripe with your show tonight, and that was your characterization of Filk, because there is original Filk that is written to its own tunes and about things such as Sassafras's I.
Yeah, but you know, that's retro thinking. The original Filkers did not feel that way. The writers of Young Man Mulligan and all the classic Filk songs were taking basically the Woody Guthrie approach, and there are those that would argue
oh,
that
yeah.
if it's written to be original, it's not a Filk song, and I'm one of those proponents.
Okay, and
my point is that Paul's album is folk music, and that's it.
Paul's album is beautiful, you know?
It
what
is. I almost played a song featuring Tina Vozic.
Well, thank you, Tina. Tina
his
Vozic,
wife.
What
right?
is it? TDQ box says if it sounds good, it is good.
No, I don't recall PDQ Bach or Peter Schickley ever saying that.
Tina played Triangle in the Break of Your.
I
Everywhere.
Could be wrong on the attribution. I've been wrong before.
Yeah. Well, of course, I worked with Peter, but anyway.
It's great to talk to you, and I. Wish you and Paul, of course, I wish you writing more books.
Right.
He's doing that. You just heard a sample.
Yes, and I loved it. I loved it. When will that one be available, do we know?
In about 6 months.
I'll yeah, say. First he has to finish writing it.
Right.
Then he has to sell it. Then it gets edited, goes back to the author,
mm-hmm.
and then it gets published. It can be a long period, and it's an unknown.
That's a shame.
But I'll get it out.
So. I know the process.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thanks for calling.
Okay, take care, sweetie.
Take care.
Thanks, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, by the way, I should tell people, if you have a tendency to call in or a desire to phone into WBAI, the telephone number here is 347-335-0818. Again, 347, area code 347-335-0818. In all my years at WBAI, the least mnemonic of all the phone numbers we've had. Also, if you happen to be watching us on Facebook, you can type in a question and I can, or comment, and I can read that aloud. And that way we can all partake, because those people on Facebook do not hear necessarily. Oh, God, I didn't turn off the speakers on the Beatles song. Well, we'll have to deal with that.
What is that?
Turning off the speakers means that it isn't on Facebook.
Oh, I see.
And it's a song by the Beatles.
Right.
And there, no, rights.
Got it.
But, okay, yeah, and therein lies the issue. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Levinson.
Hello.
It is nice, me being a retired academic myself, to speak to another academic. Do you prefer Mr. Levinson or Dr. Levinson?
You can actually call me Paul.
Paul, yeah. Okay.
Dr. Paul to you.
Dr. Paul, okay.
Brief.
I'm just wondering, was Laura watching the old or the new Battlestar Galactica? Hopefully it was the new one.
100% the new one. Who in their right mind would watch the old one?
Fred Astaire, you want the answer? Fred Astaire fans. You wanted to honor Fred Astaire, you didn't watch.
Right.
And lovers of Alpo dog food.
Right. You know, one of the nostalgia channels, dare I say, is actually running that dog at midnight on Saturday
really?
Night.
Well, of course. I mean, camp is in. And if you want to hear, by the way, some curious news,
yes.
The producer of the reboot of Battlestar Galactica is also the producer of the Amazon Lord of the Rings.
Ron D. Moore.
Yes.
He's doing Outlander. He's also doing Lord of the Rings.
Well, maybe he's doing too much.
Woo.
Electric Shepherd. Not Electric Shepherd.
No,
that's
Dreams.
A company. Electric Dreams,
right.
The TV series.
Yes.
Which, by the way, is already broadcast in England.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, we should
you mean
have
that,
gotten it here.
It'll be on Amazon
soon.
Within the next month or so.
Right.
But it's a 10 episode series, and it started in mid-October. So it's almost done in England.
Oh, by the way, British. James, so that rumor is true. Amazon is doing.
It's not a rumor.
No. That's what I said. I heard it was a rumor, but now you're.
It's not a rumor. It's a news story.
It's
a real news story.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I'm not holding out any hope.
I agree with you.
And right? So do I. And
unfortunately.
And while I don't hate everything that Ronald D. Moore has done, he's done some excellent stuff. I know at least one very well-regarded editor of science fiction books of a major, major imprint who refers to Ronald D. Moore as the man who killed Star Trek.
Oh, well, by the way, I do have a question for Paul.
Sure.
But let me remind
that is the purpose of people calling in here.
Yeah,
yes.
Let me remind the audience that before you start heaping praises and hosannas on the head of Oliver Wendell Holmes, remember, this is the same gentleman who in 1927 validated Virginia's forced sterilization law.
Okay, we were not talking about the person. We were talking about a specific decision.
Yeah.
Tell me, Paul, about your time travel trilogy. I got the first two titles. What was the third?
The third is Chronica.
Chronica,
like Chronicle, but Chronica.
Where is this set? In ancient Greece?
It's set in a variety of places. The plot to save Socrates, which is the first novel, is set primarily in ancient Athens in the time of Socrates.
Right.
On Burning Alexandria, as the title might suggest, is mostly set in the ancient library of Alexandria.
Right.
And Chronica is set in a whole bunch of different places, but for a variety of reasons, and I don't want to give too much away.
Some reveals.
Yes. It's mostly set in the 1890s.
Oh.
And I'll tell you, this is not giving too much away. One of the main characters in the plot to save Socrates is William Henry Appleton, who was a very eminent publisher at the end of the 19th century. And he published everyone from Lewis Carroll to Charles Darwin, and he gets involved in these time travel stories. So I finally decided to bring my major characters, Sierra Waters, the graduate student from 2042, and other people back to the 1890s. There are also scenes in Chronica that take place in the distant future.
One last point. You mentioned the early progenitors of Gollum.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You are no doubt aware that...
Not Gollum, but the Gollum, yes.
Yeah, the Gollum, yes. You are aware, no doubt, that...
The Czech one.
The mention of robots or automata, whatever you wish to refer to them, can be traced as far back as the Arabian Nights Entertainments. There is a story that Scheherazade tells called Abdullah of the Land and Abdullah of the Sea, in which he visits a future city in which there are walking mechanical men.
Yep, that's a very good point. I may, you know what? Maybe I'll put that into Robinson Calculator and in the acknowledgments and preface. I'll thank you.
Anyhow, when we get to the however his name was pronounced, the author of that play, who wasn't writing as much about robots as he was simply writing about involuntary servitude, because that is the story, that is the whole point behind RUR. So I call it RUR, or Have You Ever Been?
I have heard, by the way, from a Czech friend that it is Čapek.
That was my belief.
You're probably right.
Is that it's Karl Čapek.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay,
anyway,
thanks.
Anyway, gentlemen, good night.
Good night.
Good morning. Just to be contrary, I say good morning. Yes, somebody is saying there is a huge time delay here with the radio. Yes, there always is. Internet feeds take a very long time. They are often, I would say up to 90 seconds apart, even if you are nearby. And Fitzcarl, I don't know where you are watching from. Raymond E. Feist is watching. Wow, one of my favorite writers. Hi, Raymond. You may or may not recall that you and I did an interview about, 2 years ago at Lunacon, when you were a guest of honor there.
Hey, Raymond, we've never met, but good to see you here.
Yeah, that was the only time I met him. He's not a person who makes his way to the East Coast that often, but an absolutely wonderful, really understands and is one of the progenitors, I would say, one of the forerunners of really modern epic fantasy.
And he also, his family has made a really important contribution to music.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I didn't realize that.
What?
That being?
Check it out. Google Feist.
I've signed off Google because we're going off the air in about 3 minutes.
Okay.
But let's try to work in a last call. Good morning. You're on the air. We're shy on time, but there you are.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a modest suggestion for fielding calls during Facebook Live.
Mm-hmm.
I, the caller, make my statement or question. You, the host, reply, "What's that you say?" Jerry Pournelle used to expose himself to figures in the Wax Museum, and that way everybody is up to speed at once. I call it the Lassie approach.
Okay, that was a great question.
That needed a rim shot, Gary.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Go again. Have a good morning. Sigh. He could have put that on Facebook.
Yeah.
And then I could have decided whether to read it or not.
Right.
At any rate, we have about 3 minutes left because I have to put on my outro music at 2:56 and a half, and it's 2:53 and a half now. That's in order to get off the air on time. So, a brief reminder to listeners and viewers to come to the Brooklyn Commons Cafe on December 5th, 388 Atlantic Avenue, between, where are we, between Bond and...
Don't ask me.
I think it's Hoyt and Bond, but it's 388 Atlantic Avenue, to the Brooklyn Commons Cafe for... Sarah Pinsker and Kat Valenti and friends. It will not be a reading. It will be singing and a game show. It will be festive and fun. So I hope you can all join us. Admission is free. Donations accepted. Paul, what are your latest fiction and nonfiction books in print?
Marilyn and Monet is a metaphysical time travel story.
Yeah.
Marilyn Monroe and Claude Monet. And it begins with Marilyn Monroe walking off the set of The Misfits in 1960, and she hears a song in her head. Goodbye, Norma Jean, da-da-da-da. All right. And my latest nonfiction book is actually, I mentioned this before, I'm continuing to expand and revise fake news in real context.
Yeah.
It's digitally published, so it's updated all the time.
Okay, great. And people can find you online.
Well, at Paul Lev, P-A-U-L-L-E-V, at Paul Lev at Twitter, or Paul Levinson on Facebook.
Okay, but you don't have a web presence.
Well, I do. You know, my web page is, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you my blog, actually, paullevinson.net.
So, okay, that's the easiest, because
right.
That no doubt will lead to all the other things.
That's
so
right.
I always just give the web page.
All right, good.
And there is such a thing as ourwolf.com, but it hasn't been updated in a very long time. It needs a total redo. But you find me on Facebook as well. Bill Prop, Facebook is completely ahead of the FM, yes, except that every so often it has to be reloaded. I have heard this before, and that's because we're using an internet feed to the Empire State Building. And so both are internet feeds. And obviously the feed from my camera to Facebook is better than the feed from WBAI to Empire State. And that's...
There's a lesson in that.
And it's that I really like my new phone. Thank you so much for being here, Paul. It's been years.
I enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, but this is what, about your fourth time on the show?
I think so.
Something
like
that.
Third or fourth.
We'll work it in again. Thank
Great.
You so much.
I loved it. Thank you.
Okay, likewise. And to everybody out there, please, everybody, be good to each other. And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers coming your way. Oh, my guest next week, S.A. Chakraborty, author of The City of Brass, her first novel coming out with a bang and a clash. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. So tune in then. That won't be on Facebook Live because we're pre-recording. Okay, but take care and see you on the Bitstream. Good morning.
Oops.
there. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a bitch. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. Wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it bits, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. And in tune to 99.5 FM, WBAI. Flag burning time, 2 minutes after 3 o'clock. We do this until 5 o'clock, y'all.
Let's find the people who hate this.
WBAI.
.org.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran. Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talk about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torched the flag? I'm only doing what you told me.
Say she looks nice with her brand new hairstyle. I gotta say that she looks good in that new dress she just bought. Perfect makeup, perfect nails, and you can't afford a car. Everything's good, but she forgot to put sparkles in her eyes. In her eyes.
If you're just joining us, we do this until 5 o'clock.
On a marble stand.
This is one of a thousand reasons why we burn the imperious red, white, and blue before 5 o'clock here.
Trying to find the ocean. Looking everywhere.
Eric Gale from Barbados, the island of Barbados, on guitar. And now the reason why we burn the red, white, and blue. Burn, baby, burn.
Got my sister Sandy and my little brother Ray. Buy a big old wagon to haul us all away. Live out in the country. Never gonna come back here till the day I die. Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to live? Cause I don't want my boat to be rocking in.